Hi, I'm Bob Acton, the host of the Color and Ceramics podcast, and welcome to the show. We've got an exciting show today, talking with the wonderful Carol Long, a ceramic artist whose work blooms with the influence of plant and animal life. Infused with joy, whimsy, and a deep connection to nature, Carol's intricate organic forms reflect her Kansas farm roots and a lifelong curiosity for the beauty around her. Her pieces can be found in galleries and museums across the United States, and she shared her artistry in workshops nationwide. From childhood experiments with mud to internationally recognized ceramic sculpture, Carol's journey is one of imagination, craftsmanship, and an ever-evolving exploration of the natural world. Welcome to the show. Carol, thanks so much for joining us today on the Color and Ceramics podcast. I am super pumped about having you on board here. I love your work. It's complicated, detailed, full of color and life. And of course, I love animals and nature and whatnot, which is really reflected in your work. So thanks so much for being here.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. This is great.
Yeah. It'll be fantastic. I wonder if you could tell people a little bit about your journey into clay. Just before we started this interview, you were telling me you work full time in your studio. And so can you describe for us kind of your journey from when you started getting addicted to clay, as I call it, and to where you are today?
High school, and maybe even before that, if you call, having your favorite toy being the sandbox or the driveway full of dirt, if you want to, go that far back. But I had a really great teacher in high school, Sheldon Ganstrom, who's a raku artist, and now he's a raku artist, and we had just a phenomenal class. I went to a very small school. Our graduating class was 38, and we were a large class. So we had a really great art class, and Sheldon Ganstrom was really excited about clay at the time. We went to raku shop workshops at a local college, and it just exploded from there. But I didn't really know that I was addicted yet until I went to... You know, you gotta have that period of becoming addicted, but you don't know it. And I went to a local community college and spent all my time in the ceramics lab, all my time. I mean, I know I took other classes and I passed and I graduated with an associate's degree, so I know all that happened, but I really don't have any memory of anything else that went on except for the ceramics lab. So that's when I knew I was addicted. And so that's the totality of my formal education as an associate's degree. But then, of course, lifelong learning and paying attention to people who are in academia. I'm very grateful for people that do go that route because that's how I find out about really great things. So I'm not really in that world, but I pay attention to that world so that I can see what's going on.
Yeah.
What's happening?
Yeah, I agree. I think there's lots of really interesting things going on out there in clay. And as I've got into doing this podcast, there are millions of people who are doing really cool things with clay. And so there's lots of opportunities to learn. Who has influenced your, what are the sort of cultural or historical influences in your work?
I think that initially, well, and I didn't even know this was happening at the time, but I love antiques. And when I first married, I was 19 and very poor. I mean, I came into our marriage with $300 and a little powder blue Pinto, and that's all I had. And But so I loved antiques, and in order to buy a piece of furniture, I had to go to an auction and buy it really cheap because you couldn't buy interesting furniture new, and I couldn't afford that interesting furniture. So the only way to find that interesting artifact would be to go to an auction and wait and buy it cheap, cheap, cheap. So I loved going to auctions, and so I saw a lot of that early 1900s pottery. There were some functional things like crocks and things, and those were influential. But I found that, like, Roseville pottery, and I have a few pieces of that. I'm not a collector by any means, but I think that was the beginning of some influence other than the people in academia.
What was it
So
about
I
that? What was it about that work that influenced you, that caught your eye?
think it was the softness, the calmness. It was all about floral everything. I mean, the functions were for floral design. The surface design was beautiful flowers, and the glazing was very, very soft. And I noticed that years and years later, that's how I would spray on all of my glazes, and I would come have a beautiful soft feeling over the whole thing. So that work that I just described was all about form and how the glazes flowed over that form, and with that really that softness.
Yeah,
So I really love that.
it's interesting as you're talking about going and buying antiques. I see antiques in your work. With a lot of the movement of many of the pieces, that it just seems like that's a real natural link between your what I'm envisaging to be the sort of antique work that I know that came from my family into your clay work. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, and I love Art Nouveau. Now, I wouldn't have found any Art Nouveau to speak of out here on the Kansas Prairie, but I sought out examples of Art Nouveau and Art Deco and the arts and crafts movement. I love all of that period.
Yeah, that's very
And
interesting.
I'm almost sad that I'm sad that Art Nouveau didn't hit the US like it should have.
It's interesting how different countries, different cultures have really different experiences with clay and pottery. You really get a different sense of if I'm interviewing somebody from England or France or the United States, it's really quite different.
It didn't come here. Well, and it didn't really last very long either, that period. So,
Now, could you describe, this is going to be an audio podcast, so people are just listening to it and imagining your work. Could you describe how your work has evolved? I went back on your Instagram feed to look as far back as I could get and see that there has been an evolution of your work. I wonder if you could tell people about that and what where you're at today in terms of the style and the kind of work that you're doing.
So like all artists, I had that learning period where you try everything. And so you're flipping back and forth from different clays, different techniques, colors, designs. In the 80s, I had just a one very, very small studio here at my home, and I used red clay and white glaze, and that was it. That's what I had. And so I would do a single firings, glaze the piece, carve through, and it was all very geometric, and the pieces were thrown and not altered to speak of. And it was all about showing my throwing skills and surface design, but it was all very structured. And then I had kids. We had three children, and they were very close together. And so life went from having all this open-ended time, although I was actually the farm hand at the time. I was the farm wife, farm hand, and those are, full-time jobs. And then we had three kids, and that's another full-time job. So my mind couldn't handle sitting down and carving like those early pieces. And so the next step was just really fast, if still single fired, really fast drawings through colored glazes and still using that red clay. Now, and this is all while I'm, still studying what's going on in the ceramics world, even though, I'm out here on the prairie with three kids and have all these things that I need to pay attention to. I decided that I was going to make a sugar bowl, and I didn't want to make it out of earthenware, and so I bought a cone five clay, about, I don't know, 500 pounds. Of
Oh, just 500 pounds.
yes, for a sugar bowl, and it just took off from there. And that's the same clay that I use today. It's Laguna's Cone 5B mix, and then I found that all these great colors go wonderfully over this white clay. So that's where I finally moved from earthenware up to mid-range, thinking that I would always go to cone 10. I've never gotten to cone 10, and I don't know that I ever will, So, and then I started doing, well, I did all the flowing sprayed on glazes that that flowed beautifully. And then I discovered, well, and I did a lot of slip trailings for those glazes to flow over, but not structured, like, well, I shouldn't say structured, but not as precise as what I do now. And then I started trapping those glazes inside the slip trailing, which is what I do now. I do it kind of like, so that brings me up to what I do now. And it's kind of, if I can think about it, or explain it as like a coloring book, or cloisonné, how you would trap the enamel inside an area. That's what I do now. So,
And
and cake decorating, if you, yeah,
yeah, of course,
cloisonné,
I'd see that
coloring
cake
book,
decorating
cake
thing too when
decorating.
you mentioned it. Yeah, absolutely. And so you are not doing any spraying anymore, I would guess, because that would be pretty hard to do. Are you applying it with a brush, or how do you do your application though?
Brushing is very, very messy. And so it's all with small squeeze bottles. I have a squeeze bottle that I like. I should have that. Oh, I should have written that down. It's from Axner, and I use a very small metal tip on the end, and it's 0.7. It's like the middle tip that you can buy from Axner. And I know there's some really great ones that have long tips on them, but they tend to clog and be more of a problem. I mean, they all clog. Even the little short one that I use, I'm always unclogging that. But it's just short, and so it's easy to unclog. The long ones I don't even deal with. So yeah, so that's the slip application and the glaze application are all done with these little application bottles from Axner. You can buy that. You can buy the bottles online, Amazon, but I have never found the right tips anywhere but Axner.
Very cool. Now tell us a little bit about your design work, because it's very interesting, right? So how are you approaching your design work, where you're applying the slips and the trailing so that you can capture the colors in between? What how you think how are you working that?
I'd like to say I have a plan from the beginning, but I don't ever, because the shape of the piece, I'd like to follow the shape of the piece. And sometimes gosh, where do I even start? I don't know. So many times I will treat it as a flat surface. So I'll treat it as like a painting because I apply the slip with gravity. And so I have to think of it as a flat piece. Am I making sense?
What do you mean
And
by apply the slip with gravity?
I don't actually touch the surface of the clay with the tip.
So you're pretty close
Which,
to the surface.
yeah, and if it, some of my best designs, I shouldn't say design, some of the best slip trailing is like if I'm an inch away from the surface, so that it has a really smooth, graceful line. And sometimes with the flick of a wrist, I can get an interesting line. Wow, how do I describe what I do?
Do you feel like when you get too close to the work with the tip that you lose that flowing sensation for yourself?
Definitely, definitely. And starting and stopping. It makes a lot of jagged lines instead of smooth flowing lines. So, well, along with cake decorating, cloisonne, coloring book, you can add in their contour drawing.
I knew it was complicated.
Yeah, so if you could have a continuous line on something without overlapping too much, that would be perfect. Yeah, starting and stopping. I've been doing a lot of like patchwork designs on some mold-made animals, and that's a lot of jagged lines, starting and stopping. But the best lines are like fluid, open, just the following the design of the shape of the piece, as well as what I'm trying to do with the imagery on the piece also.
So you've got the imagery to deal with, the form itself that you're having to think about as you're beginning to apply. How do you think about the form in relation to the slip and color that you're doing?
Now, most of the color, like the glazes and things, are pretty much decided while I'm doing the slip trailing. And so that's where all the fun is in the designing and thinking about what colors are going to go where and how this shape is going to start and stop, and how they're going to do next to each other, the glaze colors next to each other. So by the time I get to actually glazing the piece, all the design is like gone. I mean, done. And that the glazing gets pretty tedious. I have the TV on a lot when I'm glazing because it gets pretty. The glazing actually is kind of boring. So, but
It'd be pretty small work too if you're using a tip and a squeegee process, right? Yeah.
yeah. I forgot what your question was.
I was just interested in your, like, I'm always interested in this notion of color and design with respect to form, right? So I remember the first instructor I ever had was all about form. He didn't care what was on the surface. It was all about form, right? And then other people are focused on surface, and I think they're a combination of both to make it beautiful, right? And in your case, you've got great form and you've got beautiful colors. So I was just interested in how the two go together for you, how you think about that.
I don't know that I'm thinking about color when I'm actually making the form. I am just trying to follow the clay into the form. I used to think, like in my early work, that I needed to show that I was a skilled thrower. And now I'm like, throw the piece, and that's just the beginning stage. So that's a skill in throwing. I would recommend that potters learn to throw just because it's a fast way to go up. It's a really great skill to have. It's a fast way to go up. It's a fast way to make a bottom on a piece and get your sides up so that you can create from there. And I like a thrown piece because the clay is in such movement that it can be pushed out and pushed in, and still be very graceful. I push out mainly from the inside. I feel like it makes the piece look full. It looks like it has, a lot of volume. It looks like it's plentiful rather than starving. If you push in, I think of starving. If you push out, it's like it's plentiful. So I do like those ideas to come across in the work too.
I was just going to say, you mentioned that you use molds for some things, and you're talking about throwing. Do you tell us a little bit about that? How the molds, the work you do with molds fit with your throwing process?
Well, I have made some molds for myself. I decided that I like to decorate little tiny boxes, but I don't like to make tiny little boxes. So what a perfect thing to make is a mold for a little tiny box
Box.
so that you can spend your time decorating. And if you have made tiny little boxes, you know how much time it takes to make a little tiny box by hand building. So that is a great reason to make a mold. So you make your box, you make your mold of the box, and then you can start from there. I also, these molds that I was talking about of the animals, a friend of mine moved and she had a garage full of molds that, of course, she bought a kiln, and the only way they would let her buy the kiln is if she took all the molds too. And so everybody's learning that story of, from the 60s, 70s, and even 80s of all these pour shops that had huge amounts of molds and are trying, the generationally they're trying to get rid of them because they take up too much space. Well, anyway, I thought I'd alleviate her of all her molds, and I brought them back and I picked out which ones I wanted. And there's like a basset hound, there was a rhinoceros, there was even a cat. There was a cat that my grandmother had made me in 75. She made me the same exact cat as I had the mold of. And so I made the cat and did it with my patchwork design on it. And then, of course, set them together and took pictures like grandma and I are making ceramics
Things
together.
together, yeah, for sure. That's a great
So that
story.
was fun. And I probably won't ever do these molds again. It was just a fun thing. And, using those old molds. So.
Now, do you make your own glazes?
No, I do not. Making glazes means that you're very precise. And you can follow a recipe. I can't follow a recipe in the kitchen. And so when I come out to the studio, I'm like, why am I even bothering to do that? I'm not precise. I don't know. I can't do it. I just can't do it. I don't have the head for it. I just don't want to do it. So I buy commercial glazes and I look at boards like anybody else and say that one's pretty and that one's pretty and that one's pretty, and I have no idea what's in them, so I go that route. Another thing about the glazes is that I've noticed that I don't use a lot of glazes that are just opaque, just are flat. Like have I use some, and they have their applications, they have their purposes, but I've noticed that I like a little bit of movement, a little more richness than just a flat color. And I have tried to use underglazes a little bit here and there, and they're just too flat too. They don't have enough movement in the actual glass, the actual surface of the glaze. So I don't use underglazes.
And what kind of, or what's the brand of glaze that you like working with?
Oh, well, all of them.
Okay.
I use Potter's Choice, Laguna. I have some Amoco. I'm not coming up with all the names, but
That's
yeah,
okay.
I
Yeah.
use,
A
yeah.
mix. You use a mix of whatever catches your eye. It's kind of like a painter, I'm imagining, right? They've got all their tubes of paint, could be all different brands, and you're in the same boat as that.
Yeah. And some glazes, when I put, like, some glazes run a lot, and they only look good when they run. So I have to put glazes underneath them that don't run, or they all run to the shelf.
And we don't want
So
that.
some things you like, oh, well, look at that design. Well, no, that was a glaze stopper. That was just to stop the glaze from
Just,
hitting the shelf.
yeah. Yeah, cool. Now, do you teach at all, Carol?
I do. I'm not a very good teacher. I'm pretty good at workshops because it's just an explosion of work, 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 and learn, learn, learn. And I learn so much from the people that come to the workshops, and they tell me that they enjoy the workshop. So I must be pretty good at that. I have been on the board of a historic building in our little town, and I found myself a reluctant director of this art studio that we've started in this historic building. It's a photography studio, and he has these wonderful north windows. It's just a magnificent space. It's a great place to work. And I have been teaching ceramics, and we just started programming, and we need a director that knows what they're doing. Because I am an artist, and I like quiet, open-ended time with zero interruptions, and that's not what teachers do. They have to be in helping somebody else in their journey, in their experience in art. So if there's anybody out there that would love to be a director of a small arts studio in a small town in the middle of Kansas, in the middle of the USA.
Call Carol immediately.
Yes, please, immediately. But I do enjoy the workshops, but it is a I'm kind of on a at the workshops, I'm kind of on a high of teaching and talking about how this could be implemented in other people's studios. And then by the end of the weekend, when everybody goes home, I pretty much collapse. So yeah, I need a day.
They are pretty tiring for sure. Now, one of the things that I've noticed in one of your advertisements for a workshop is you talked about encouraging people to push their design or push themselves into new work. Can you talk a little bit about that? Like what's that about? How can people do that? What do you mean by that?
Well, my work, sometimes it'll go through the firing, it'll come out. I've done all these processes on it, and I look at it and I think, oh, I should have pushed that. I should have pushed that farther. That could be more accentuated. That could have gone out farther. That could have defied gravity a little more. And that's what I mean. So you, let's say you've made a piece, you think it's adequate. Adequate is my new word. It's adequate. And then you just push it. Just push it. Push it out one way, push it out the other way. Does that, what does that do? Is that enough? Probably not. Push it again. Just to go to the extreme. And like even like making a handle as you could see in my work, not a lot of my handles are functional. And I used to hate to make handles. And I think it's because I was strapped to function. And so now my handles are not functional at all, and I enjoy making handles, and they're such a huge part of the design. They go out into negative space and they come back in and flow into the design in the piece and then back out into negative space again. And so I can use the air around the piece, even though it's not actually the body of the piece, I can send the design out into the air. And that's just pushing it, and not necessarily being adequate. It could be adequate.
Could be good
Push
enough.
it. It's good enough.
How do you get people to push themselves? Sounds like you push yourself, right? You see your work and you go, I could have done that differently. I could have pushed myself, pushed the piece more. But how do you help your students push themselves?
I think they need permission.
Hmm.
I think they need to have permission to go outside what they have been doing. You might be in a rut. You might be at the moment just trying to do functional work, and you're not pushing that work, the design, the aesthetics of it, like you could. You know, they just need permission. You may ruin pieces. You may ruin them. I mean, I have a really nice shard pile. I kind of like my shard pile. The pieces that are in the shard pile look better as shards as they did as whole pieces. And you just got to accept that. You need permission to break a pot. You need to permission to and you need to give yourself permission. I mean, I can say, hey, push that. But when you go home from the workshop, you should still have that permission to push that design out into space.
What do you think holds people back from getting engaged with that process of trying new things, of going to the extreme, as you talked about?
I think other people's perception, or what the artists think other people's perception is. What the artist thinks is expected of them. And, you know, I've said all through this talk that, you know, I'm from this little town. I live on a farm. I'm surrounded by farmers. And mostly everything's very practical. Except for in my studio, you come out to my studio and there's nothing practical that comes out of my studio, practically, you know. And I just feel like I was expected to make soup bowls and mugs and, you know.
It's kind of like the
So,
rules. There's
yeah.
these I was going to say informal rules, but I don't think that's even the word I want. This myth of a rule that I've got to make a certain kind of thing. The handle needs to be this way in order for this piece to work. And we often work with these rules in our head, like we've in the clay work. I found it's very technical. I need to know how that glaze works with that clay at what temperature and so on and so forth. And so we can get hung up on those rules, and they can allow us to experiment and broaden our horizons, or they can restrict us, I think, is what I hear you saying.
Yes, definitely. And you said it much better than I could. Just even learning to make a handle on a mug, you're going to hear from one person, this is how you do it. And you're going to hear from another person, no, this is how you do it. And you need to be able to say, well, this is how I do
That's
it.
right. You have to get rid of the should in that statement, right?
Yes.
You should make it this way versus this is the way I want to make it.
And one time I was at a Soldner workshop, and I noticed that he never said you couldn't do it. Never said you couldn't do that. He'd say, you should try it. You know, if you had a suggestion, he'd say, you should try it. He never said, don't do that. Maybe he should have sometimes said, oh, no, don't do that. But he never did. And I thought, wow. There you are. There, that's magic.
Really, that's the freedom of art, isn't it? The ability to think outside the box and engage with that thinking to make the piece, whether it's a painting or a book, if it's a writer or a musician or a potter or a ceramic artist, right?
Yes. And I noticed that I don't even, well, it some I don't make sketches. I don't have a sketchbook, and I know that lots of people do, and they really benefit from that, and they like the whole process of having the idea from the beginning clear to the end. And I change directions so often through the process of one piece that a sketchbook is a, would be a hindrance, I think, to me.
What do you mean you change while you're making the piece?
I will find that the clay is moving in a new direction other than what I may have initially thought, and so I will follow that direction and see how far it can be pushed. So, and then of course that's going to change your surface design down the road, and so those initial pushes in the clay have changed everything right off the bat. So, yeah.
Now, where do you think you might be going with your work? So we've talked about your past and where you've come from and what you're doing these days. Have you got an idea of where you might be headed with your work?
I don't, and I never do.
Yeah.
And that's the fun of it, 'cause I love the discovery. And like I said earlier, I'm working with this nonprofit art center, and who knows what I'm going to come across there, and what new direction that could take me. Just by teaching, you learn so much. So I really have no idea. I just want to always do excellent work. That's why I like my shard pile so much, is that if I feel something is just adequate, it may get the hammer, you know. I'm going to have to see some new things. There are always going to have to be some new things.
And
So, yeah, I can't answer them.
are the new things for you, obviously they're inspired by other artists as you've talked about, but you've also got a lot of nature in your work. Do you find that inspiration from a new flower or a new bug you met or a new bird you ran across?
Yeah, definitely. And I noticed that I don't do carnivores, because many of my animals, I put them in, you know, what they might be doing, and carnivores are like always on the hunt.
Yeah, that's
So,
right.
and it's different if you're like a deer hunting for a leaf. I mean, you know, that's really sweet. But a coyote hunting for a rabbit, you know, not so sweet. So I usually try to use the animals doing something that is fulfilling, like would be a fulfilling activity for a human, you know.
Yeah, it's got a nice energy about it. It sounds like then.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But I walk my dogs almost every day, you know, down a dirt road with weeds and wildflowers and all, you know, all things surrounded by that. And I just sometimes when I'm out there, I just am like, this is magnificent. This is it. And it's just walking down a dirt road. And I think, wow, I've made it big.
Yeah, there's so much to inspire us from nature, isn't there? Yeah, it gives us a sense of balance and calmness, I think, that maybe you can take back to your studio.
Right, and calmness. And that's what I would like to convey. You know, when if somebody buys a piece of my work and they have it in their home, when they see it, I would love for them to think, or not necessarily think, but feel joy or peace, and just be surprised by something in the work, you know. So, yeah, I would like for them to feel.
When I look at your work, a smile came on my face because I think it's great. But it's also the kind of work that you could find something new in there every time you have a look at it, because there's lots of things to look at in the work.
Yeah, and that's my goal. That's my goal.
Cool. Hey, now, you must have had a challenge in your work that you've encountered somehow that you had to overcome. What was a challenge that you encountered in your art journey?
Well, there's something that's kind of, well, it's not technical, but it happens every piece. When I lay my slip trailing lines down, when I'm glazing, those lines have to be cleaned off, or the glazes will attach to each other over the top of the slip trail line. So all of those have to be cleaned off. And that is tedious. So it's not necessarily a challenge, it's just tedious. But I guess my challenge is doing it adequately every time.
Even though it's tedious.
Yes, even though it's tedious. And many times I'll do something really dumb and I will just sit and look at that and think, I've been doing this for 40 years and I did that disaster all by myself once again. Sometimes you just have to mess up so that you do it right the next time.
Absolutely. Hey, now I always ask one of our interviewees about some advice they might have for somebody out there who's, I often think about somebody who might be more junior in the clay world, and what kind of advice you might have for somebody about how to up their game in terms of what they're doing.
Well, I'm sure everybody would say this. You just have to work. I mean, you got to put the time in. You have to put the time in so that you can concentrate and you need to be able to look at what you're doing and pick out things that are great about it and discard things that are not great about it. And you need to go with that. But I would just say hours, 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 hours. And that's what I've done. If people say, do you want to do such and such in your spare time? You should be able to say, spare time? I don't have any spare time. My spare time's in the studio. That's my advice is to work.
Work, work, work. One of the things that I found helpful for me was doing things in a series. So instead of making one thing and then doing something else, I said, Bob, you really need to start doing lots of work. And so let's make a whole series of the same sort of piece in order for it to improve with each iteration. So it's the same kind of idea, I think.
No. And my series, because I do that too, would only be like seven pieces. I would not be able to go beyond that with an idea unless I go back to it. I would only set out to do 5 to 7 pieces. And then if it was a great idea, then beyond that. But yeah, I find that I get bored pretty fast if I try to extend it more than that many pieces.
I hear you. I get bored very quickly with stuff too. I made in my studio this week made 8 things. I got 6 finished, and the seventh one was sitting there, and I was now I was bored, right? So I just sort of left it there. So
Yes.
I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, and that was a good idea to leave it, you know, that because the seventh piece might have just been
Just
adequate
adequate.
instead of wonderful.
Exactly. Just good enough. Yeah, absolutely. Hey, Carol, thanks so much for being on the show today. I really appreciated it. It was a great conversation. And I will, of course, put links to your website and Instagram page up on our information sections, and so that people will be able to find your work and connect with you. And I hope somebody reaches out to be your director in your arts center
Oh,
in your small
yes,
town.
please call me.
So thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. And thank you for archiving all of these wonderful artists. You know, this is just, it's great.
Yeah, it's
Good
been
job.
fun. Yeah, thanks so much. All right, see you later.
Okay, bye.
Thanks for listening to the Color and Ceramics Podcast with Bob Acton and his guests. Please help others find the podcast by subscribing to this podcast wherever you find your podcasts, such as iTunes, Spotify, Amazon Music, YouTube, or other podcatchers. And don't forget to give us a review. We'll see you next time.